ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The contrast with rail really is quite stark, and it really fails the pub test to think that, you know, we can be interacting with trucks on the road that must be lit up like Christmas trees, yet we allow rail rolling stock to make their own decisions, and in some cases really have not much at all.
The Australian Trucking Association adds to calls for improved lighting on trains for greater safety at level crossings. That story soon. And we head to the Kimberley to look at the challenges of living off-grid at the mercy of generator power. There's high fuel costs, food waste, and a network of extension cords running across the community during the wet season, raising safety fears.
From camp to camp, from house to house.
From the generator.
Yes. You know, and it's laying on the ground, and it's been laying like that for 5 years in the wet season.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. The Australian Trucking Association is calling for new legislation to force rail freight companies to install better lighting on their locomotives and wagons. Last week here on Australia Wide, we heard from WA pastoralist and rail safety campaigner Lara Jensen, who is also calling for similar action. She's been fighting for better railway lighting since her brother and two of his friends were killed at a level crossing in the year 2000. Currently, there is no legal requirement for trains to be lit to a particular standard, and some rail wagons have no lighting at all. While the Office of the National Rail Safety Regulator is developing a voluntary code of practice for train illumination, Australian Trucking Chief Executive Matthew Munro says that doesn't go far enough. He spoke to our reporter Angus Verley.
We've got around 20,000 level crossings right across Australia, and about 79% of those are unprotected, relying really only on signage to keep people safe. We think better lighting on trains and rolling stock could really help the safety situation. Between 2014 and 2022, we've seen 39 lives lost on level crossings and about 49 serious injuries and several thousand near misses. There are many factors at play here. One of those is visibility of trains. So we've made a submission recently to the Australian National Regulator for Rail Safety, and we have called for stronger requirements for visibility and illumination of trains, including rolling stock. The current situation is that there's no requirements at the moment. There is a proposed code of practice. That code of practice would not be mandatory and would not be enforceable.
So as it stands, there's no legal requirement for trains and their wagons to be illuminated to any particular standard?
No. Laws currently require everyone operating a workplace to do so safely, but there's no specific requirements relating to train lighting. While the code of practice would be an improvement because it would give some direction about the types of visibility that might be helpful, the final decision about the lighting standards for any particular train and carriages would be left up to the individual rail managers.
So you want legal minimums, legally binding standards?
Absolutely. So I represent the trucking industry. We have around 60,000 trucking businesses that we represent. All of those trucks and light vehicles, I might add, on the road are subject to mandatory minimum standards for lighting and reflection. That's a very, very good thing. I think when it comes to safety on our roads and our rail crossings, you really can't leave these things to chance or to discretion of individuals. We need to have a minimum standard. I think all Australians would agree that having a minimum standard of lighting, say on a light vehicle, say with headlights, brake lights, on all the reflectors, etc., is a fantastic thing.
And modern trucks, particularly, as you say, people would have seen them on the roads at night, extremely well lit, both the prime mover but the trailers. Typically seem to have rows of lights both along the tops and the bottoms and the rears of them. It just seems worlds apart that that's the standard for trucks, and yet for trains, people have probably encountered it. You can be going along a road at night, you come up to a level crossing, and through the darkness you see these wagons crossing a level crossing with no lights on them at all.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The contrast with rail really is quite stark, and it really fails the pub test to think that, we can be interacting with trucks on the road that must be lit up like Christmas trees, yet we allow rail rolling stock to make their own decisions, and in some cases really have not much at all.
And I think I can recall a conversation probably 20 years ago with someone just about this. I think they'd had a near miss with a train with no lights on its wagons on a quiet country road late at night. I mean, why hasn't this happened in 2024?
Look, I can't answer that question. All I can say is that it certainly does need to happen. But one of the elements here may well be the regulatory models that apply to trucks versus trains. In the road vehicle space, we have a very strong national heavy vehicle regulator, very strong laws and very strong vehicle standards, which all vehicles must meet. Whereas in the rail space, you tend to have a self-regulatory model where those making the decisions about the standards that apply to the rolling stock are those that operate the rolling stock themselves.
You said you've made a submission to the rail safety regulator outlining essentially what you've discussed with me. What prospect is there that you get what you're asking for?
The consultation is taking place on the basis of there being a code moving forward. Now, while a code may provide some guidance to users, it's really up to the user to decide for themselves whether or not they adopt the code at all and whether or not they adopt any of the particular elements that are specified in the code. So one of the things we've asked for is better specificity within the code about the kinds of things that rail operators ought to be thinking about and doing, and making sure that they test those with road user groups as well, so it's not left solely to the discretion of the rail track operator, because what we'll have then is we'll have different standards across different parts of the network, and I don't think anyone really wants that. But what we'd ideally like is to move away from a code and make the lighting requirements mandatory. That will require a decision of ministers outside of this consultation process, and we're certainly making our views known to ministers. We understand that during the consultation process, there have been many groups, particularly community groups, road user groups that are vulnerable to collisions with trains, that have called for exactly the same thing as we are calling for. And so we hope that ministers will listen. We hope that we take a different path on this particular issue, and that ultimately, if not in this consultation process, but alongside the consultation process, there will be an eventual, if not immediate, move towards mandatory lighting of trains.
That was Matthew Munro, Chief Executive of the Australian Trucking Association, speaking with Angus Verley.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company here on Australia Wide. To WA now, where a major shift occurred on July the 1st last year in the way the essential services of water and power would be managed at almost 200 West Australian Aboriginal communities. The Department of Communities, formerly Housing, handed over management to energy provider Horizon Power and the Water Corporation. Horizon Power took on an additional 117 communities in the restructure. It already managed 53 community power supplies. And as Vanessa Mills reports, the upgrades can't come soon enough for some Kimberley residents.
We don't have power during the day, and my freezers always turns off. And at times, during the last 6 years, I had to throw the fridges and the freezers, and I've thrown a lot of white goods away in the rubbish tip because of that situation. And my food, if I come to Broome and I spend a couple of days here, I go home and everything's all rotten. The fridge is all rotten. I have to clean it or throw the whole lot out, the fridges and the tucker.
William Smith lives at a tiny family community on a block leased from the Aboriginal Lands Trust, 180 kilometres north of Broome. He spends almost all his fortnightly pension on diesel, which at $2.45 a litre is quickly gobbled up by the generator.
If I'm able to afford it, because at the moment I'm on a disability pension, and all of my money goes to generator fuel. But when we can't afford it, we go without.
But the cost isn't the only pressure eating into William's conscience. It's the dangerous homemade grid he set up to get the electricity from the Jenny to the cluster of homes. long extension cords plugged together snake through the dirt and grass, up trees and across branches and verandas, and into a multitude of power boards.
From camp to camp, from house to house.
From the generator?
Yes.
Do you have to try and remind the children to take care not to touch the extension cords?
Well, that's all we can do.
Yeah.
That's all I can do. You know, and it's laying on the ground, and it's been laying like that for 5 years in the wet season.
Imbalgan is one of many places that can expect improvements now that electricity service and supply to 117 West Australian communities is under the management of the state utility, Horizon Power. It's got a mammoth task ahead to assess all the communities scattered across a vast area of WA, as Horizon's Crystal Skinner explains.
It's quite a large program of work that we've identified that we do need to undertake. And I think, you know, to sort of, I guess, set expectations, it will be a program of work that will carry on beyond probably the next 12 months and over the next 5 years or so.
Horizon Power's budget is $50 million over the next year alone to fully assess and fix issues.
There have been some really immediate safety and reliability improvements that we've been able to identify. A good example of that is we identified some cable that needed replacing. We've been able to identify some issues around some of the cabling and wiring and sort of installations behind the meter that we've been able to work with communities to get repaired.
Ultimately, what's your hope about the normalisation of electricity supply for 117 communities, Crystal?
Our North Star that we're really looking towards from a Horizon Power perspective is that sort of by the start of the new decade, so from 2031 onwards, we'll be able to really look back retrospectively and say that this program has helped support closing the gap for Aboriginal communities. And that's really, I guess, why the WA state government did commit to its program to improve power service delivery across remote communities.
Crystal Skinner says Horizon's also planning for communities like Imbalgan to be moved to solar power.
Solar power would be more than an answer to my prayers at the moment. It's just that everything I do is subject to generator fuel. Like every fortnight, I can't buy what I need to buy. For myself, it all goes to generate a fuel.
Kimberley pensioner William Smith ending that story from Vanessa Mills. It seems inflation is affecting most aspects of life, food and household expenses, fuel, insurance, travel. But it seems these rising costs are also contributing to city dwellers looking to head to regional towns to finish off their elaborate tattoo designs. According to Mildura tattooist Shiva Das, Australians in capital cities are travelling further afield to save money on their tattoos. Mildura reporter Tamara Clark has this story.
To probably finish it off, I'm probably looking at adding maybe an extra $2,500 into it, maybe $3,000 instead of just getting the arm done. I kind of live with a patchy tattoo and areas where it kind of looks a bit funny, so.
Nick Carrick is from Frankston, an hour south of Melbourne, and that eye-watering price is what he expects it'll take to complete his arm tattoo. And it's not his only half-finished tat. He's got another unshaded piece on his thigh that's also unlikely to get done as the cost of living soars through the roof.
I've spoken to a lot of mates. A lot of people are saying that they're looking at getting tattoos removed if they can't finish sleeves just because it looks like unfinished and it doesn't look like the way we're wanting to.
And all those missed jobs are hurting tattoo artists too. Just ask Beth Kirk from Meiji Tattoo in Adelaide.
Things have definitely slowed down a little bit. There's been less new inquiries coming through and some of my more regular clients have sort of spaced out their bookings a little bit just due to financial reasons, which is very understandable with the price of, you know, rent and mortgages and all that going up. And you can't really be mad at clients for that, you know, different priorities, I guess. It just shows that people are putting more emphasis on the things that they're prioritising to a higher level, like engagements or, you know, spending money on rent and bills and things like that. I had another client recently who was unfortunately just lost their job, so that's obviously another thing too. It seems to be kind of widespread through the industry. It's not just me specifically or just our shop specifically. Some of my other friends have also noticed that their more regular clients are spacing their appointments out a fair bit too, not coming back every couple of weeks like they once were. It's more, you know, a month or 2 months in between appointments.
Beth reckons tattooists in the city are doing it particularly hard because at the end of the day, it's cheaper for customers to travel, pay for a tattoo and come back than to get inked locally.
It is definitely still happening. Hard to argue with, you know, getting a full back piece in 4 days for maybe half the amount it would cost you here, but that doesn't necessarily speak to the quality of the tattoos that you're getting.
Tattoo trips to Bali are nothing new, but you might not have to look so far to get a bargain. Shiva Davis works in Mildura, over 500 k's from Melbourne, but he says he gets fly-ins every couple of weeks.
So we have people drive from Swan Hill, which is a couple of hours away. We regularly have people fly up from Melbourne, and they can stay for the weekend, get tattooed, and it's going to cost them less than getting tattooed in the city.
Shiva charges $200 an hour, so he's not cheap, but he says the difference is still big enough between Mildura and the city to make the trip worthwhile.
We get a few stories, like some tattoos, even if they're an hour, 2 hours, they are costing about $700, $800 sometimes. I know a few people in the cities have day rates of like $2,000, $2,500. So I guess when you look at our prices, it's about 50% less in that way. I think there's an oversaturation of artists in the metro areas. Regionally, it tends to be pretty quiet. I think a lot of creatives and artists like to group up together in those CBD areas. Some of us just like to be nice and quiet and tick along with our work out here, and things have been good. Yeah, cost of living's a lot greater in those areas. Rent's higher, food's more expensive, things like that. I guess your income's greater there, but here you tend to get a lot more for your dollar, definitely.
Not only is he winning Cap City customers, Shiva reckons the regulars in Mildura aren't slowing down.
I find that regional customers, they're very appreciative, and we see the same people come back every week. Some customers come every fortnight and they almost become like family.
Turns out knowing how to ink beer cans and keeping strong local relationships is a winning combo.
A lot of football tattoos and beer, lots of beer bottles.
So could a regional trip fix Nick's half-finished tattoo trouble? He's already doing it. But he says in his part of Victoria, the party might already be over.
Originally, I was getting some of my pieces done down at Dramana. I had a really good apprentice down there that was quite reasonable in price. Now down that area, because there's just limited as well tattoo shops, their prices have gone up.
Mildura's Swan Hill reporter Tamara Clark with that story. And finally, here on Australia Wide, it's a long journey from Western Australia's wheat belt to the stage of one of the biggest pop stars in the world. But for farm girl turned musician Grace Nugent-Wordsworth, she's proved all it takes is a bit of hard work, determination and fresh country air to be able to open for megastar Pink. Kate Forrester has this story.
One moment that could change everything.
You're looking out on stage and you're seeing like 20, 30,000 people on the first night, maybe 40,000 on the second.
Grace Nugent-Wordsworth's whole life had been building to this.
Like, just my stomach was just, like, churning, like flipping up and down. So I was like, you might only get to do this once in your life. Like, I don't want to go out there and, like, regret not giving every single part of myself. The first note started. What did I say? I can't even remember. It was a blur. It was like, how are you going, Perth? And they went... It was so crazy. Like, night two was like the greatest time of my existence.
But it had been a long journey to that moment. And it all began a world away on a country farm in Western Australia's wheat belt.
Got the birds, got the horses. It's really peaceful and I think it's really nice to have a balance. But I love the lake, especially in wintertime, and I love the green grass out here on the farm. And I feel like if I go for a walk down to the lake, get out the guitar, it's so creative. And I think that stems from childhood here, just a different way of living, you know, having a really hard work ethic, like on the holidays or even as a kid growing up here, I was, you know, up at 6 a.m. with my parents out scooping poop and feeding animals and, you know, picking rocks from the crops. And we were always busy. There was always a drive to, you know, you can't just leave the animals. There's always a lot to do. The farm life and horses and you know, working on the farm has really taught me, one, hard work and drive, and then obviously a lot of patience.
But it wasn't the typical country farm life in Williams. The farm was an organic and biodynamic farm, so chemical-free.
My parents are very different people. You know, it was a very hippie, free, spirited upbringing. And, you know, whilst I had a really, in many ways, a wonderful time in Williams, like when my sister was growing up especially, it was really difficult because there's a lot of chemical farmers around here and people didn't understand what Mum and Dad were doing. At the beginning, everyone thought they were witches.
They weren't. But it was a tough life on the farm and a hard upbringing. But it was one full of music.
It's just funny without, it's weird almost without the third half.
We have a very musical family. I honestly think it was probably my mum because she's a singer-songwriter and I grew up actually just like travelling a lot with her for music. She was always, whether it was she was out in a different country playing music or whether she was having a jam session out the back with our neighbours, I was always around music. Like, and me and my sister and my brother and my mum grew up on harmonies, and Dad not so much. He's more of the farming type, but loves to sing along. I remember we moved to Germany for 8 months and I was 3, and my mum was singing, and she was like, she thought I was asleep, and she came to the car and I was like, can I sing I'm a Big Big Girl? And I got up on stage in front of all these people when I was 3 years old and sang that song. You, your mother on a first name basis. I just was obsessed with performing. I just made people sit down and watch me sing all the time.
With a strong work ethic, a musical family, and a desire to be on the stage, Grace had only one dream.
The music industry is an absolute gamble. You have no idea if you're going to do well. You literally, like, my whole mindset is you do it because you can't see yourself doing anything else. You love it. And I do it because I really love storytelling. And if I didn't do it, I don't know what my life would look like.
Sometimes the odds were stacked against her.
When we were really starting to get a leg up, COVID hit and we lost. I remember getting a call in like 1 hour, we lost like 11 gigs. You know, it takes years and years and years of work to even, like, for us personally, it took us like 5-6 years to even start touring nationally.
But she kept pushing.
Even now, regional touring is a struggle.
Along with her band, Joan and the Giants.
Ticket sales are really, really difficult. Like, you have to put things out over and over and over again and hustle even to get like a few tickets sold at the moment.
But sometimes, if you keep hustling,
it was a very, very rare opportunity, which is why I say it's like winning the lottery.
You might just find yourself on the same stage as one of the biggest pop stars in the world.
When we were told we were going to support Pink, it was the most exciting moment of my life. It was really crazy. Our manager kept sending their management everything we were doing. At first, her manager said, no, we don't need an opening act. We've got Tones and I. And then eventually, like, they were just like, well, you know what? We may as well just open a slot.
The band couldn't believe the news.
Clear the calendar. We're supporting Pink at Optus
Stadium. Oh, are you kidding me?
Such a shock, because these things just don't happen.
And then came the moment. Opening for pop star Pink, live in Perth.
Like, just so many faces. And because we were just before sunset, I could see everyone. So you're seeing people up in the stands. You're seeing thousands of people in front of you. Like, it's like everyone almost looks like ants. It's like a huge amount of people. I said to the boys, I was like, don't feel stressed. Like, let's just go and have the time of our lives. Like, we've done this hundreds of times together and enjoyed every second of it. Let's just go out there and just have fun. And we did. We went out there, we were dancing all together. Like, everyone was so into it. And we just had the time of our lives. If I could do it again, I would do it sober. Everywhere I used to listen to Pink on this property with my Walkman and my So Fresh CDs, like running around these paddocks, screaming Pink songs, imagining I was Pink. And it's so crazy that years, years later, I got to see her sing those songs and be on the same stage as that. We've worked so hard, and I've just, like, it's not just like an overnight thing, you know. I've been trying to pursue music since I was like 19, 20, So for the last really 8 years, and things are really just kicking off now. But that absolutely is a gamble, and I'm glad I took that gamble for sure.
Joan and the Giants lead singer Grace Newton Wordsworth speaking there to our Bunbury reporter Kate Forrester. And that is Australia Wide for this Tuesday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. I look forward to your company then. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.